glad you're here. Fellowship's sweeter, knowing you're near. It's so good to see you. I hope that it's fair. Everyone loves you.
Welcome to Mark and Friends. I'm your host, Donna Leland, and today we have the privilege of talking with Michael Rydelnik. He has just written a book through Moody Publishers, How Should Christians Think About Israel? And, you know, this is so timely for me because we hear so much swirling in the mainstream media and even on Christian circles as to Israel's place in God's plan. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So glad to be with you. Really glad for the opportunity to talk about this subject that's near and dear to my heart, obviously. So glad to do it.
Yes. You might also hear Michael on the Open Line program, and you've been doing that, what, now for 15 some years?
About 14 almost, I think.
Wonderful. So wonderful. You know, that is one of the most listen to programs on the Moody Broadcasting Network. So we love you being available to answer these important questions that people have.
Thank you. Thank you. And by the way, it's on Saturdays. If someone's listening to this, Saturday mornings, and Central Time would be 9 to 11. So that would be a good time to get a chance to listen to that from time to time.
Absolutely. Well, let's launch in. And our first question is, so how is the modern state of Israel related to the biblical kingdom of Israel?
Well, you know, that's one of the issues that came up with in that interview that Tucker Carlson did with Senator Cruz. And he challenged Senator Cruz when he was talking about the modern state of Israel, blessing Israel. He said, you can't connect the modern state of Israel and the Jewish people today to the biblical Jewish people and the biblical nation of Israel. And I think that Tucker was wrong. And sadly, Senator Cruz was right, but didn't have the wherewithal. He'd never challenged that, so he didn't know about how to think about it. First of all, I think we have to recognize there are some differences. The difference is the biblical kingdom of Israel was a theocracy governed by God. Even when there were kings, it was under the rule of God. Their constitution was the law of Moses. And so there was a difference there. Today, the modern state of Israel is not a theocracy. It's a democracy. They have elections. It's the only democracy in the Middle East. They have elections. They have a prime minister and a Knesset, a parliament. And so it's quite different that way. Second way, the ancient Israel was a monarchy. And as I said, this is a democracy. The theocracy is different also because the modern state of Israel is secular. There are religious people in the government and in the country, but the Orthodox only comprise about 25 or 30% of Israel. And so there's quite a bit of difference. Also, the governance is completely different, you know. But here's what's the same. Here's the key. The biblical kingdom of Israel was the nation state of the Jewish people and the land that God promised the Jewish people. Today, the nation state of Israel, the modern state of Israel, is the nation state of the land of Israel, of the Jewish people that God promised to the Jewish people.
It's the same.
It's the same. And it's the land that God promised to the Jewish people. It's their ancient homeland. All this talk we hear today about settler colonialism, this is the ultimate example of something not being settler colonialism. In fact, early on, when the state of Israel was reborn, the Marxist propaganda about Israel being a settler colonialist state was not even in existence. In fact, that Marxist terminology was still used, but Israel was used as the example of overcoming colonialism. Because here was a people who had lived in this land, who were the owners of this land, who had been dispersed for the most part, not completely, but dispersed. And then they have come back and they reestablished their presence in the land of Israel. And in fact, the Jewish people are the only indigenous people in the land of Israel to govern themselves in the land of Israel. Every other government, when you go through the history of Israel, after the Roman occupation or control of Israel. After that, the Byzantines, and after the Byzantines, it was the Muslims, and after the Muslims, it was the Crusaders, and then it was back to Muslims, all governed from other parts of the world. And then finally, we have the Turkish and the British, and then Israel comes back into being. Once again, it is governed by an indigenous people instead of from the outside. So this is the exact opposite of colonialism. It's the restoration of the indigenous people in their ancient homeland. So that's how I would say it relates to the kingdom of Israel.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now I'm thinking also whenever they were taken into captivity through the Babylonian exile and the Assyrians, wasn't there a group that were left in the land to till the land and still be a presence? Do you think that there was always a presence of a Jewish group still in Israel holding down the fort?
Yes, Babylon, the Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity, there was always some Jewish people. But really, with the return from captivity with Cyrus the Great in 539 BC, Jewish people returned to their land. Of course, there was an ancient community that stayed in Babylon and so forth. However, most people think of AD 70, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, that the Jewish people were expelled from the land of Israel and didn't come back till modern times. That's actually not true. By the second century, the Romans had decreed, after the second Jewish revolt, that Jewish people couldn't live in Jerusalem. But they could live in Israel, and they mostly lived through the period that we think of the patristic period or the Byzantine period. They lived up in Galilee. And you can actually trace, there has always been a Jewish presence in the land of Israel, even in the great days of the diaspora when Jewish people scattered all over the world. Even so, there's always been a Jewish presence in the land. Jerusalem, for the most part, throughout its entire history, has had a majority population of Jewish people. It has always had you can trace this line that there's always been Jewish people, sometimes more, sometimes less, but always Jewish people living in the land of Israel.
That's amazing. So they probably would be considered the true Hebrews and Israelites and Jews.
Yeah.
Explain those terms. We hear those thrown around, and then you throw in Zion and Zionism.
Yeah. You know, Hebrew is just an ancient term. Abraham was called a Hebrew. Then when his son Jacob was renamed Israel, he had 12 tribes. So that people, those tribes of Israel, the people became known as Israelites. The land that they lived in when they came into the land of Israel with Joshua, that was called the land of Israel. The name was changed from Canaan to Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. And so those terms are there. And then when the Jewish people went into captivity, when the Israelites and Judah split, do you remember the 10 northern tribes of Israel? Two southern tribes were called Judah. When Judah went into captivity, they merged together with the Israelites who had been taken into captivity by Assyria. And now the Judahites were there. And that's actually where we get the word Jew from. Because Judah, then there's that's Yehudah, that's the Hebrew word. Yehudi is a Judahite, but today when we say Jew, we say Yehudi. That's the Hebrew word. So it's the word Jew comes from Judah, and it refers to all Jews, both Israel and Judah, and they were there in captivity. And so that's where that term comes from. The biggest surprise is how people have tried to turn the word Zion and Zionism somehow into a dirty word.
Yeah.
Because Zion is just the name first for the Temple Mount, then the whole city of Jerusalem in the Bible. That's how it was used. But Zionism was the hope that the Jewish people, when it began, Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, began with the hope that the Jewish people would return to their ancient homeland and have self-determination there in their ancient homeland. And believe it or not, that was affirmed first by the British government in the Balfour Declaration, and then confirmed by the League of Nations that the British would have the right to control Palestine after World War I if they would carry out the Zionist dream of creating a Jewish national home. This is an international decision that was made. And so Zionism just means Jewish self-determination in their ancient homeland. Normal stuff. What happened? How did it get to be such a dirty word? Well, initially, the Soviet government supported Israel. They voted for it to come into being at the United Nations. And when they saw that Israel had allied more with the United States in the Cold War, they turned. Mm. And they started this idea that Zionism was somehow racist. When you think about how many Muslim countries there are, even Great Britain, and a Christian country, they have the Church of England. The fact that there is a democracy where everyone has rights, Jews and Arabs, everyone has full democratic rights, citizens of Israel, but it is a Jewish state. It's predominantly Jewish, and it's Jewish self-determination in their own homeland. Well, the Soviets started categorizing this as racist, so that we have the infamous decision back in 1975 that Zionism was racist. That was a vote that was pushed through by the Soviets at the General Assembly. And then, of course, under President Bush the First, that vote was rescinded. But it stuck, this idea that somehow Jewish people don't grant equal rights to their Arab citizens. That's ridiculous, and it's completely untrue. The Arabs with the most freedom and rights in the whole Middle East are the Arabs of Israel. That's just a fact. The only place where the Christian Arab population is growing in the Middle East is in Israel. Wow. Everywhere else, it's the numbers are dwindling. Yeah, that's Zionism has been misappropriated by haters. It actually just means Jewish self-determination in their ancient homeland.
Mm. Now, in the Old Testament, we're told that those who bless Israel will be blessed, part of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, is that still in existence today? Should we still be promoting the Abrahamic covenant?
Well, there are some people who are saying today that Genesis 12:3 says, "I will bless those who bless you, Abraham, and will curse those who treat you with contempt." That only applied to Abraham. It's kind of interesting, because when the Abrahamic covenant is restated in Genesis 27, it says, God says to the patriarch Jacob, it says, "Those who curse you will be cursed, and those who bless you will be blessed." Now that's interesting. Somehow this is passed on to Jacob. Mm-hmm. And guess what? This is then passed on, we see, from Jacob to his 12 sons, who become the fathers of the 12 tribes, and the 12 tribes are Israel. So it does appear that the principle wasn't just for Abraham. It appears, for example, in Genesis 24, where it's seemingly applied to all Israel and the Messiah of Israel as well. So the point of it is that this blessing for blessing, curse for curse, is national, not just individual. Mm. And now the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional promise that God made. In fact, in Genesis 15, we see that when he confirmed the covenant with Abraham, there were these sacrifices, and the smoking fire actually passes through. That's the representation of God. And Abraham's in a deep sleep. He's in a coma there. You know, he's out. Yeah. And that means that God alone is obligated to keep the terms of this covenant. And so the promise that God made to Abraham is absolutely still in existence, and we can see it, you know, nationally, individually, that those who bless Israel have been blessed, those who cursed Israel have been cursed. I would say that one of the reasons the United States has been such a blessed country is it's been one of the few places where the Jewish people have had a welcome place. It's scary to me now to see what's going on with the rising anti-Semitism, both on the right and the left, because Jew hatred is going to bring a curse, is the idea of bringing a curse on Jewish people. And I think we're jeopardizing our nation if we tolerate this. But, you know, you could even see what happened with Spain, the greatest naval power on earth, defeated that 1492. They expel all the Jews from Spain, 300,000, the greatest Jewish community in the world at that time, expelled. By 1517, the Spanish Armada defeated and Spain becomes a second-rate power. It happens over and over again in history that when nations turn against the Jewish community in their midst, when they expel them, when they attack them, anything like that, the result is that God withholds his hand of blessing. He withdraws it.
Now, does blessing Israel mean that we have to agree with the current government of Israel? Do you offer any thoughts on that? How do we differ the two?
Yeah. Well, first of all, just remember that even in Israel, many people disagree with the government of Israel. Israel, like the United States, is a very divided country in terms of right versus left. And so at least, you know, in fact, they've had difficulty with elections in recent years, not this last government, but in recent years, they've had difficulties even getting a majority for either side. Israel always is divided. So, for example, I have cousins who live in the north of Israel. They can't stand the government. Mm. They oppose the prime minister, but they love Israel. Mm. They love their nation, and they are very strong supporters of Israel. And I think that's important. That we recognize that, you know, all of us don't always recognize and agree with, we recognize, but we don't always agree with our government
right.
in the United States. Of course, we can disagree with the government of Israel. Now, that doesn't mean that we automatically attack the government. I think that there's something to be said. A lot of people say, well, I don't agree with this war. Well, I think Israel was compelled. I don't talk about the war in the book. But Israel was compelled to defend itself in this war. And so here's what I think. I have four caveats for how to disagree with the government of Israel. Okay?
Okay.
First of all, we can disagree, but we shouldn't delegitimize the state of Israel. In other words, I may disagree with the government. I may disagree with the prime minister. But that doesn't mean I say Israel shouldn't exist. Mm. Secondly, my second caveat would be not to apply double standards to Israel. Sometimes people say they disagree with Israel and their standard for disagreement, but they don't disagree with Syria. They don't disagree with Nigeria. They don't disagree with any of the other governments. They don't disagree with China. And those countries are doing very seriously wrong things. And they then apply a double standard. They expect perfect righteousness from the government of Israel. No government's going to have that. I do think that Israel has behaved in an amazingly, they've had failures, no doubt about it, but amazingly caring way to try to avoid civilian casualties in this war. And yet, every time there's a civilian casualty, which is going to happen in war, it's an aspect of war, people start screaming and applying a double standard to Israel that is not fair. Mm. And the third caveat besides delegitimizing, not applying double standards, but thirdly, we dare not demonize Israel. There are people who, whatever happens, will demonize Israel. No matter what action they take, it's never good enough. Israel is always people always find fault. In fact, you know, a person may not agree with the prime minister of Israel, but he is being portrayed, for example, right now as the incarnation of all evil. Mm. That's just not true. So we shouldn't demonize Israel. We shouldn't demonize the government of Israel. There are people in the government that I strongly disagree with. I wish they weren't in the government of Israel. But that doesn't mean we demonize the whole country. And then lastly is we should beware of believing deceit. So we shouldn't delegitimize, we shouldn't apply double standards, we shouldn't demonize. But so much of the demonization of Israel is based on falsehoods. Mm-hmm. The deceit out there, pictures taken that are from other wars. You know, they had pictures of starving children in Yemen.
Yeah.
And they were portrayed as Palestinians starving in Gaza. Now it's come out, now that the war is over, there was no famine in Gaza, although it was stated. There are many things that are done deceitfully. People, pictures, sadly, of suffering people, and it's always portrayed. They're taken from all over the Middle East, and then they are attached to Israel. Many things, you know, Israel was accused of bombing a hospital early in the war. The missiles of Israel, it turns out it was Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and it wasn't even a hospital, it was the parking lot. It wasn't 500 people dead, it was about 20. But it wasn't even Israel that did it. And yet the story went around the world, as Mark Twain would say, before the truth could put on its shoes. Mm. And so we should beware of demonizing Israel based on deceit. And so those are my four caveats. I call it the 4D test of criticizing the government: delegitimization, double standards, and then demonizing and deceit.
We're listening to Michael Rydelnik, and we're talking about his book, How Should Christians Think About Israel?, helping us to wrap our brain around our current situation when it comes to some of the thoughts and the rhetoric that's being spewed concerning this group of people. Well, thank you again so much, Michael, for taking time out. I know your busy schedule.
And always a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate you so much. Thank you so much for joining us here on Mark and Friends. Mark and Friends is a ministry of Great News Media, a listener-supported Christian ministry. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to the Lord, for He is good and His love endures forever. Thanks to the Lord, for He is good and His love endures forever. He is good, and His love will forever endure. We will bless His name as we all proclaim His love endures forever. Adonai Yeshua Teinu.